Hello, this is Karen Griffin introducing Space to Bees podcast on people and performance, leadership and love. Conversations with leaders, practitioners, experts, authors, and anyone with extensive experience and good insight into the world of work in the 21st century.
Hi, today it's great to introduce Andy Meehan, a highly experienced chairman and non-executive director of PLCs, private equity-owned businesses, privately owned companies, public sector organisations and charities. After qualifying as a chartered accountant, he enjoyed a 30-year executive career, mainly in retail, consumer products and related sectors, and ultimately became a finance director and chief executive. Since 2006, he's built a portfolio of non-executive appointments across commercial and public bodies, and he's also a turnaround consultant. With significant turnaround and restructuring experience in well-known businesses, plus three successful exits as chair of private equity-backed companies under his belt, he's also going to be able to share his thoughts on leadership in those contexts as well with us today. We could go on, but I think let's get started with the interview and allow what is pertinent to reveal itself on this broad discussion on leadership and leading boards and leading executives, etc., etc. So welcome, Andy. It's fabulous to have you with us.
I feel like a lie down after that intro. Exhausted.
I have to say that was one of the longest introductions I've ever given. So, but you're worthy of that, Andy. You know, you've got a fantastic career behind you. So it's important to let the listeners hear what you're bringing today in our chat. So is it fair to say that you're a leadership veteran?
I really get upset about that, you know. quite a number of years ago when I moved jobs, the retail trade magazine put me down as a retail veteran joins XYZ company. I thought I was still up and coming at that point, but anyway, there we are. So by now, definitely, I am a leadership veteran, yes.
Excellent. So we've got seven leadership questions for you today, and no doubt many follow-ups. Some of these relate to executive leadership and others board leadership. I'm going to share the seven questions now so listeners know what's coming and they can decide whether or not they want to stay listening to it or not. So briefly, in your 30 years of executive leadership experience, what behaviours would you say are key for any leader in 2022 and why? So that's going to be the first one. Number two, in what ways have these important behaviours changed in the last 20 years and why? Number three, for any leaders on a journey of transition out there, perhaps from more authoritarian styles, what advice do you have for them? Number four, you've been leading boards as chair since 2006. How is the experience of leading board directors different from leading executives? Number five, what similarities are there? Number six, what do you see as the top three leadership challenges for boards in the next 5 years? And finally, for anyone thinking about embarking on a career in leadership, what do you wish you'd known when you were 21 or 22 years of age thinking of doing the same? So I'm looking forward to hearing some of your humorous stories along the way today, Andy. So over to you and question one. So in your 30 years of experience, executive leadership experience, what behaviours would you say are key for any leader in 23 and why?
Okay, well, of course, we're talking about leadership, but there's also management is important too, and there are differences between the two, but actually in many ways the sort of behavioral qualities that we're talking about at this point are probably applicable to both, so we probably needn't get too worried about that distinction. But if you think about it, there are at board level, a board is made up of two types of people. There are the functional leaders. Everybody is a functional leader around the boardroom table, the buying director, the finance director, etc. But they also have to behave as a collective, as a group of people exercising their fiduciary duties in running the business, and also having an outward facing aspect to them. So in terms of each has to be an expert in his field and therefore has to be credible in that role. They also have to take an interest in what each other does, which is vital because, for example, you can't become the managing director or the chief executive if you're just a key functional specialist or the chair. You have to be aware of what the others are facing in their issues, in their responsibilities. So in terms of behaviours then, I think the key word for me, and it's always been the word, is to be authentic. So many people suddenly switch on when they walk into the office or the boardroom and behave like some swaggering idiot sometimes, or some whatever image they have in their mind of what the director or chairman or chief executive should be. I mean, that's just nonsense, frankly, these days. People see through that immediately.
Yeah.
Having said that, part of that is then also being respectful to everybody else around the table. And maybe that's something we'll come back to later, because it's no good being authoritarian anymore. It doesn't work. You have to be respectful of others. And while I'm talking about being authentic, I don't necessarily buy into this philosophy of bring your whole self to work. Mm-hmm. Now, everybody wants to do that all the time. There are times when you have to, particularly if you're a director or a senior executive. You know, you have to give everything to the issue, to the problem. But actually, sometimes people want to go home and play with the kids or football match. And you have to respect that, providing the job gets done. And thirdly, I suppose, recognize that you as the chairman or the chief executives, we're talking about leadership here, don't always know the answer to every question. And allow other people to give you advice and to take the lead on subjects. Surround yourself with great people, because you don't know the answer to everything. So be authentic, be respectful, and be humble, I suppose, summarizes all that. Yes. And behave with the responsibility, because you do have responsibility for other people's well-being and happiness. Now, that sounds incredibly soft, and people who know me say, what's he talking about? That doesn't sound like Andy. But it's true. You know, a happy board is an effective board.
Yes.
And that's the chairman's job. And the same applies to the chief executive with his team.
Yeah. Really great thoughts. And you've mentioned the word responsibility, and everything you're also saying there makes me think leadership is actually a privilege, isn't it? You have so much influence over people's lives, both your immediate team and far beyond that. Thank you. So moving on to the second question, in what ways have these important behaviours changed in the last 20 years, and why do you think that is?
I think a lot of it's about this last point we've just touched on, this idea of responsibility to others. And you would never have talked about people's health and well-being 20 years ago. We were much more authoritarian and prescribed then. I suppose, in a sense, people had fewer options. And the person who got this right for me is a chap called Charles Handy, who was an eminent business writer. He was also a religious correspondent, I think, as well at the time. But in 2002, so this is almost exactly 20 years ago, he wrote a book called The Age of Unreason, where he predicted the rise of the Shamrock organization. Now, prior to that, people thought of their career as a pyramid. You joined a large company at the bottom and you worked your way up, and eventually you got to the top. He said, that's all going to finish. It's all over. We don't have that. We have shamrock organizations. Now, a shamrock, picture a shamrock. It's three interlocking circles. One is the core activity of the business. Those are the experts who know how to do whatever it is the business does. The second circle is outsourced providers of services which used to be in-house. So the window cleaning, the office cleaning, that sort of stuff. People would employ cleaners in the past. They don't anymore. They employ a cleaning company. Mm-hmm. And the third one is the workforce, which is temporary and changing. People will move in and out of jobs. They won't spend the whole career in one company. He predicted this in 2002. It's the precursor to the gig economy, for want of a dreadful expression. Mm-hmm. And all the problem with it, there are two problems with it. One, it's harder to manage because you've got moving pieces much more. People are much more flexible, and they will join and leave organizations much more readily than they used to. So planning is more difficult. But actually, for the individual, Charles Handy said that In the old days, in a pyramid organization, a career was 100,000 hours. Now that is 47 years, 47 weeks a year, times 47 hours a week. That's what a career was. That's more or less 100,000 if you do the maths. He said, in the future, it's going to be 50,000 hours. And that actually is 37 times 37 times 37. But what it isn't is 37 years for 37 weeks at 37 hours a week. It's a mixture. You work really, really intensively for a few years. You then might go traveling for 2 years and live off your savings. You might go back to university. It's a much more flexible lifestyle. Mm. The problem with it is that he didn't explain how you fill the economic gap between the earnings of 100,000 hours and the earnings of 50,000 hours. And that's a problem we have today.
Yes.
Compounded by cost of living and mortgage rates and all of that. Now then, so that's the big change, which reinforces this need to be authentic, to be respectful, to be mindful of others instead of just bossing people about.
Yeah. It also requires leaders to be just probing a little bit on that, to understand that concept and the context in which they are living and leading. And it requires a different type of conversation, doesn't it? And a mindset shift around what a career is and an acceptance of that from the employees that leaders are managing, and leadership skills to have those kind of talent conversations around when you're moving in and when you're moving out, and the flexibility around all of that. That's very different to how things were 20 years ago. I was doing this 20 years ago as well. And it's great that this was almost identified as something emerging in 2002, but we're not yet living it. We're kind of almost crawling towards it. And it's a painful process because some of the broader context isn't supporting that. As you've mentioned, mortgage rates are really high. The cost of living is really high. So many people can't afford that sort of existence.
Well, I think in terms of recruiting people as well, in the old days, if you had a reputable company that was well established, people wanted to join it.
Yes.
Now you have to sell yourself to candidates much more than you used to have to, because they have, or at least they perceive they have more choices, and some will have, genuinely. I mean, there's so many more startups now. There's so many, you know, the whole tech sector didn't really exist to the extent it does now. The whole startup sector, people doing their own business, was not the thing that it is now. So to get people to work with you, you have to be more flexible. You have to offer fixed term contracts, flexible working, all that. It's all fine. It can all be made to work. But don't get me started on working from home, because that's a whole different issue altogether, although clearly it's wrapped up in some of this.
Okay, so in terms of behaviours then, it's flexibility, it's respectful, it's bringing people with you, it's involving, it's great communication, it's being authentic. Very different to perhaps what you'd have been taught 30 years ago when you were coming in, and what your bosses would have expected you to have been like back then.
I mean, it's yes. In the old days, there was a hierarchy. You know, you to do something, you went and did it. Now you're entitled to sort of understand why he wants you to do it, and you know.
Okay. So moving on to our third question, for any leaders on a journey of transition out there, perhaps, you know, initially starting their own careers using that more authoritarian parent-child type leadership approach, what advice do you have for them? Because I think you've made that transition, Andy, haven't you, in all honesty?
Yeah. I was always, as you can imagine, a fairly stroppy young executive or young worker. And I didn't like being treated by authoritarian bosses in an authoritarian manner, because I'm a Yorkshireman and, you know, we don't like that. You can always tell a Yorkshireman, but you can't tell him much. And that was in some ways a problem. So basically, my essence of this is you treat other people as you'd expect to be treated yourself. You can't go far wrong if you do that, because everybody has a job. The jobs have got the value in them. Yours happens to be boss of the company. It doesn't make you a better person than the more junior employee who's serving the customers in your shop or over the phone or whatever it is. And I think another little tip is talk about we rather than I. You know, I remember I was a finance director of a well-known retail company at the time, and we got a new chief executive hoisted on us by the group. And he kept talking about, I've got a stock problem, I've got a price. And we kept saying, no, you haven't. No, you haven't got anything. We have got a stock problem. We have got a profitability problem. It took a while. I mean, that was a long time ago, but it was such an irritating thing then, and it's even worse now. And in a sense, a lot of people work as consultants because they're not being treated that way. They don't want to sign up for the hierarchy as it remains, because they don't like being told what to do. Mm-hmm. They like to feel they have an element of freedom as to how they deliver their objectives. So and treat others as you'd expect to be treated.
Very good. Have you ever known a situation where a leader just can't make that shift? I mean, you've obviously led many leaders and helped them improve their own leadership style over the years.
That's why you have so many people who prefer to be self-employed, to avoid coming into that situation. But I think most people, certainly in the circles I have been fortunate enough to move in, get it. One or two spectacularly don't, and they fail these days. They usually fail because their authoritarianism takes the aspect of, I know the answer to everything, and they patently don't. So mistakes get made and they're shown up for being inadequate. And that's the problem. So if you're using team and we instead of I, you stand a better chance of being more successful than if you don't. But it's out there. Not many as they used to.
So you've been leading boards as chair since 2006. How is the experience of leading a board of directors, non-execs, different from leading executives?
Right. Well, this is interesting, and it really depends on which sector you're in. Because broadly, if we take a distinction between the corporate commercial sector and not-for-profit and charities, there are two very different dynamics. So in the corporate sector, the obvious point is the board that the chairman leads is a mixture of execs and non-execs. And mostly people are being paid for being there. So that's a subtle but important point. You're there as a non-exec or as a chairman because you bring sector expertise. So everybody around the table knows about whatever it is, engineering, IT, retail, whatever your business is. So you're all knowledgeable about it. The opposite is true in the public sector. So if you have a public sector or a charity board, they are unpaid, they are volunteers, and they come from a wide variety of backgrounds. They have the one interest, which is to further the cause of the charity or the organization, which whether it's be a hospice or a homeless charity or whatever it might be. Executives are generally not on the board. So the issue you have to work out there is treating them as the hired hands. Sometimes the trustees think they run the place. They do legally, but they don't actually, right? So that you have to nurture the bit that says, I want to hear the executives talking much more than I want to hear the trustees talking. I want the executives to be leading and the trustees to be challenging, questioning, and then supporting.
Yes.
Clearly, during crisis, it's different. The trustees have to become more hands-on. But I think you have to bear that in mind. And I chair both types of organisation, as you said at the beginning, and you do have to behave slightly differently. Although, going back to my earlier point, if you're authentic and you're behaving with respect, it's actually not that much different for a chairman to get the best out of people in either sector, frankly.
Your point there, Andy, about if you're authentic, it's not that different. In your experience, you haven't required a different approach to having happy, productive boards in those two different contexts. And you believe that's because of your own authenticity. I've been a trustee for you, and you have a natural presence and gravitas. And, you kind of know what you're doing in, and you have a natural confidence in that domain based on years of experience. So for you, it probably isn't that different in getting the best out of your trustees or indeed non-exec directors.
Yes, and I think so long as you realise that in a corporate board, you can say to your fellow non-exec directors, listen, we've got an issue here. We have to bottom this and we have to make a decision by tomorrow night.
Yes.
Please, everybody, give some focus to this and we'll have a phone call at 5 o'clock tomorrow, okay?
Yeah.
You can't really say it that way in a charity. You can say, listen, we have got some issues here. I need some help. And you have to ask rather than demand. Both, you could argue, are being authentic, but you just recognise the fact that on a charity board, they've all got other jobs that they get paid for. They've got other priorities. They're giving their time and expertise for free. But equally, if they do that, they have to recognise that they have to commit as well.
Yes.
And in some ways, I've often found that it's more of a commitment to be on a charity board that you're not getting paid for, in terms of stepping up when it's required, because it's really required, than it is a situation where, you know, you're being paid and you're in it and there's more regular contact with the executives usually.
Yes, because you're playing to people's hearts, I suppose, and flexibility. And I suppose you get a situation where you've got those who do and those who don't step up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then you think, well, why did you bother signing up for this? And you sometimes ask people ever so politely, are you really up for this? And maybe be better off not doing it.
Exactly. But unfortunately, some people do it for their CVs rather than to actually add some value.
Indeed.
So as an experienced chair, what kind of leadership qualities do you want the board to have?
Again, we're almost talking two different things here with commercial and not-for-profit. In commercial, nobody really cares who the non-execs are, right? They know who the chief executive is, they know who the executive directors are, and that's important. So the non-execs are kind of behind the scenes, and they don't, and it's very dangerous sometimes for the non-execs to walk the shop floor and talk to people because they can give misleading insights. Sometimes I fell into this trap as a young non-executive, in fact, as a young chief executive as well, I fell into this trap by thinking aloud.
Yes.
If you think aloud in front of members of the workforce, they'll say, oh, Andy said that, and off they go and do it. No, actually, I was just thinking, you know, what if, and speculating. So it's quite dangerous talk costs lives in some ways. In a charity or not-for-profit, you're very often inspected, whether it's by CQC or Ofsted or those sorts of people, and you are expected to be visible. So, you know, in a hospital, if you're on a hospital board, the chairman is expected to be seen around the place and for people to know who he or she is. Now, again, as I've just said, that can be really dangerous if you're not careful, but you are required to do it. And when CQC come in, they'll expect you to do it. So you have to show leadership in different ways in those different circumstances. Many chairmen, let's talk chairman for a moment, like to be the ones who are in front of the press and in front of the TV cameras. My view is that that's nearly always not right. The chief executive runs the organisation, and this applies commercially, not for profit. He's the one who gives the interviews, unless, of course, you have a major issue or a major external problem. So I prefer a fairly low-key, behind-the-scenes approach, working with and through the executives. That's how you lead properly. The executives are the ones with the accountability, and you have to encourage, help, support. And occasionally, yes, you have to be there up front, usually when the crisis, which is not very nice. But I think that's the style there, that the board is a collective in most situations, but it's the executives have got to do the doing, frankly.
Yeah. And back to, you know, strengths and characteristics of great board members generally. I mean, you and I often talk about different pieces of work that we may or may not get involved in. I think we were only chatting about one yesterday, weren't we? So I think each trustee, if we go back to trustee boards, And we've to look to, you know, what does great look like when we're thinking about their skills and capabilities. Each, it has to be unique and bespoke for that organisation. However, there will be some similar capabilities that will be common, throughout all trustee boards, and probably, I'm asking rather than telling, more commercial boards. And it would be good just for the listeners for us to summarise what they might be.
Yeah, well, I think that on not-for-profit boards, it's very important that you have an appropriate range of skills and experience around the table amongst the trustees. And so most boards should do an annual skills audit, which says, who have we got that's good at finance or marketing or HR or facilities management, whatever it might be, and you recruit accordingly, because you usually have more trustees than you do have non-execs on a commercial board. You might have up to 10 or 12 trustees on your board, so you've got the opportunity. The trick, however, is not to fall into the trap of filling gaps in your executive capability with trustee recruitment. And too often, trustees either want to or feel they're being pushed into actually doing real work for the charity. Now, that's okay as a one-off, as an exception, if you've got a particular issue. But it's not the way to go forward. Because if you do that, the trustee's role has changed perceptibly so that they can no longer hold the organisation to account if they're the one who's been preparing the business case or doing the fix or whatever it might be on the topic in question. So always get your executive capability right, get your mix of trustee skills so they can ask the right questions in the right way and be constructive and challenging. Excellent. So that's the trick, I think.
And all of that applies for corporate non-exec boards as well, doesn't it? There's nothing that would be different.
Exactly. Although it's more appropriate for a paid non-exec to get a bit more involved than it would be for a trustee, partly because they are usually, you used the term earlier, veterans. They are veterans in the field.
Yeah.
So it's not unheard of for an experienced finance NED to go off with the finance director and do a little project together and help them with it and put their name to it, because it's more collegiate. You're more together as a unitary board rather than a set of trustees holding a group of executives to account, which you are in the charity sector, for example. But equally, it's a fine line. Fundamentally, the idea of the NEDs is to provide insight, wisdom, some grey hair, and some appropriate challenge.
Yeah. The some grey hair. Do we really mean that? Are we?
I mean, in my case, it works very well, so I've got plenty of grey hair. But grey hair metaphorically, which means that, and I know there's a huge trend to have less experienced, more diverse non-executive directors on boards, and that's fine, but there's no point in them being there if they don't have the experience and the knowledge to contribute. Because legally, they're, you know, yes, it's not clever for them. It's not clever for the organisation. But equally, diversity is something I haven't touched on yet, but it's very important. And that's partly what that skills mix is about.
Yeah.
On the charity board that we've just been talking about. So I think the essence of all this, both on commercial and on trustee boards, is you're not there to make sure necessarily that the executive team make the right decision. You're there to make sure that they've reached a decision in the correct way. So if you're a trustee of a charity in the health sector, you're not going to be an expert in health. So you don't know whether they've come to the right decision in investing in a new branch of the hospital or whatever it might be. But you can ask them about the evidence they've used, the thought processes, what projects they disallowed in arriving at this recommendation. So you can be sure that they've been through the process properly. And that's a good thing to think about, I think.
Thank you, Andy. It's all really interesting. So brings us nicely on to that next question, as we're talking about diversity and the almost crazy world that we've been living in the last 3 years. What do you see as the top three leadership challenges for boards in the next 5 years, you know, going forward? given how the marketplace is just constantly changing, there's so much disruption, have you had any thoughts on that?
I think about it all the time, really, because all boards are thinking about this. I mean, as you know, I currently chair 5 organisations, and we have conversation all the time. And depending on which sector you're in, I think the number one issue for me is this one of workforce and recruitment. And this is particularly important post-COVID. It touches on the working from home thing. So it's no longer straightforward to be able to recruit people to do what you need to do. There's all sorts of complications. You know, more and more people want to work part-time, more and more want to work from home, more and more want to work on fixed-term contracts. So
just to stop you there, but I was just let's link that with the earlier conversation around the Shamrock organisation and the projection around that. Don't these flexible requirements make that a greater reality?
Yes, absolutely, they do. But it doesn't make it any easier to manage.
No, of course it isn't. Yeah,
what I'm saying. So, for example, one of my businesses, we sell tea in fancy caddies, gifts, tea gifts, like the coronation. And it's a small business with a small workforce, but we have outsourced designers who we say, we need a new tin for King Charles III. And they go off and we employ them. Whereas in the old days, we'd have had 6 people in our own office. And actually, in that circumstance, there's a huge advantage because you can change your freelancers. They want to be changed. They don't want to work for you forever. And they get fresh ideas, particularly in something like a design environment. So, yeah, it's, you know, you outsource your IT. You might outsource your warehousing and distribution, but you've still got. And, of course, to a certain extent, you then pass the responsibility of the workforce and recruitment to that outsourced company.
Yes.
But equally, you share it, because if they let you down because they can't recruit people, you're in trouble.
Yes, and it brings as many opportunities as it does challenges. And if we think about what are some of the leadership challenges associated with that new model, you have to build long-term trusting partnerships, or exactly, at least almost decide to the extent of what that partnership needs to look like. You're going to need to let go of some of your own, intellectual property some of the confidences, the internal confidences that you would have otherwise had. It's the old-fashioned consultancy turn around, stick to your knitting. So organisations are having to strip away some of the periphery internal functions that they would have otherwise had, so that they can focus on what they're really good at and trust others to be brilliant in their spaces of expertise.
That's exactly the essence of this Shamrock organisation. And you're right. Rather than being a manager of, let's say, the warehouse, you are a negotiator in a partnership arrangement with the person who manages the warehouse, because that's what they do. You also have to recognise, and you hinted at it there, is that that warehouse organisation, for want of an example, will be providing those services to your competitors in all likelihood, as well as to you. So there's a whole area of concern there that you need to manage properly and have a great understanding. I mean, this works very well in the vast majority of cases of my experience.
Yes.
And it's great. And in some cases, it's even better because you can switch the service on and off as you need it. You don't necessarily need it all the time.
True. So that was the first kind of key leadership challenge for the next 5 years. So, and it comes under the umbrella of workforce and recruitment and the different shapes that, you know, the future models are going to be moving towards. What else?
Yeah. Well, I think we've got the whole economic situation at the moment. We've got inflation, we've got recession, have we or haven't we? And we've got the effects of Brexit. And I don't care what anybody says, we have not sorted out the post-Brexit trading environment. I mean, my companies who export to consumers in the European Union are having to set up companies in Holland and do an interim export to them. They then do the paperwork to export it to the bloke in Germany who's buying the stuff on mail order. And you know, nobody can tell me that that was how it was supposed to be.
Mm.
And having said that, imports are still flooding in from the European Union. with no frictions. So, and I'm not getting into remain or non-remain, it's done. We have to, but we have not yet created a way of doing business post-Brexit. Yeah. And of course, inflation and cost of living and recession. So everybody at the moment is paying out, all my companies are paying extra money to people to help them with bills and what have you. And I think the reason it's in the top three leadership challenges, and I hope it's not for the next 5 years, but it's the one that's here and now.
Yes.
Of course, we have to look after people. Going back to being authentic and being responsible and treating people with respect means right now just making sure that they're not starving their kids or not heating their homes or all of that. So
that's, yeah. Gosh, it's very striking, that is, isn't it, that we're having that sort of conversation in 2023 in a first world country.
The essence of it, I started this point by referring to Brexit, which of course is relevant, but actually we have seen real wages not really go up for the last 16 to 20 years in this country.
Yep.
And if you look at it, they've had it for even longer, and you see the levels of deprivation and the disparity between the haves and the have-nots, and we are getting very close to that here in this country, and it worries me because, you know, I have retail businesses, and, you know, we have to pay people more than the minimum wage.
Absolutely, yeah.
In these businesses. So that's a worry. At the end of the day, it means you pay more to recruit people. So the two points are linked. Workforce recruitment is, you have to pay more, so the cost base goes up. That adds to inflation, so it kind of goes around in a circle. So those are real challenges right now. But to your question, I hope they don't exist for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
And the final one, the third one, I suppose, is linked to that. It's what I call political instability and interference or lack of it. I mean, we have a government that doesn't have a plan for anything. And that's not a party political point. It's just where we are at this point. This government, we don't have a food strategy, we don't have an industrial strategy, we don't have a power strategy, you know, we don't have a trade strategy. And actually, it's quite difficult. Now, I'm lucky. I work for SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises, where these big factors don't really matter. But if you're running BP or the National Grid or Unilever, these things are important, because companies are doing the government's job by investing in renewables and research and all that sort of stuff. And it must be an absolute nightmare not knowing what the government's policy is on stuff.
Gosh, so three huge leadership challenges for the next 5 years. What does that mean for the kind of non-exec directors that are right and fit for purpose during this stage of our evolution?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because non-exec directors used to get to retire. There'd be people who'd had executive careers. They get to retire and think, I know, it'd be nice to be chairman of something. So they go and be chairman of something. It's what I call the gifted amateur, in a sense. But more and more, there are people like me who do it for a living. So I've been doing this full time for 16, 17 years now.
Yeah.
I was not driven into it. I opted to go this way because I was ill for a while, and it changed the way I thought about things. So the professional non-exec director is very important. So you might be on several boards, a bit like me. I hope to think I'm a professional non-exec. I do some charity as well as commercial, and that's important. And under the Shamrock organization, which we keep coming back to, there's an opportunity for younger people to work part-time if they can economically and do some non-exec stuff or trustee stuff. And that's brilliant too, because you don't want 67-year-old blokes comprising your board. You want a whole mix of people. That's the whole point of it, the cognitive diversity.
Yes.
And so I think we're going to see much more variety in what a NED looks like, I hope.
Yeah.
Able to make themselves available to do, because they are required by, non-execs are required by law, trustees are required by law, we need them. And more and more people are showing an interest in it, and it's becoming a really interesting, worthwhile. Instead of the great and the good in their tweed jackets and, you know, all the rest of it, there's no disrespect to them, but they don't look like that anymore.
Your insights, Andy, are fantastic. They're deep, they're broad, and it's a fascinating conversation. For anyone thinking about embarking on a career in leadership, what do you wish you'd known when you were 21, 22 years of age and thinking of doing the same?
I think I've been incredibly lucky because I didn't plan any of this. I just responded to opportunities as they came along. So I would say to people, enjoy the moment, enjoy what you're doing, learn and learn and learn as you go, and then respond to opportunity as they occur. And don't be afraid to make mistakes. I mean, it was more serious back in my day when in the hierarchical situation, if you made mistakes, but it's less so now. Actually, we seem to have focused on the shamrock thing, don't we, quite a lot?
We have, it certainly wasn't our intention, was it?
It's actually a useful way of thinking about, you know, the whole way work life works at the moment. And I think, you know, there is scope for changes of direction. I know my daughter seems to change her career every 10 years, and it's great. She does different and fulfilling things. And I'm grateful that I have been on the board of so many different types of organization. It's just been fantastic. It's been a privilege, and it's been constant learning and development. So just relax and go with the flow and respond to opportunities, to summarize, I think.
And work hard. I mean, you've worked incredibly hard, and that also produces a bit of luck along the way, doesn't it?
Yes, as Gary Player used to say, the harder I work, the luckier I get. He was an ancient golfer, by the way, to anybody of a different generation. But you're right. You've got to get into the position in the first place where you become acknowledged in your field, that you know what you're talking about and so on. And then leadership opportunities will present themselves.
Yeah. Andy, it's been a huge pleasure chatting to you. As expected, a very valuable conversation. So, thank you so much and farewell.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.